We're continuing the discussion of particular mitzvahs that an individual may transgress for whatever reason, and this time he is discussing about mitzvah between man and his fellow man, particularly having spoken about Lashon Hara, gossip and slander, that are so often transgressed because one thinks very lightly about the potency of words and the seriousness that one's speech might have. And then he went on to talk about hatred and seeking vengeance. And he pointed out how difficult it is to restrain oneself from seeking revenge when one has been offended or harmed, and that a person may easily justify this by saying, well, I'm only giving the other guy back what he did to me, and he deserves every bit of it. In fact, he says this is so difficult to restrain that to master, and he said this is something that only angels could do without great effort. And it requires a maximum effort to control one's passion and not seek revenge. And yet he says this maximum effort is what the Torah requires of us. Now, what is revenge and what is carrying a grudge? And both are forbidden by the Torah. He says, "V'inyan hanikima v'hanatira," taking revenge or bearing a grudge, yadua is well known, as the Talmud explains. Dahainu nekima, taking revenge means lehimona mehetiv lemisha lerotza mehetiv loy, to refuse to help someone who had refused to come to your aid when you needed it, or someone who actually harmed you, and now he needs your help, and one says, where were you when I needed you? That is an understandable feeling, which he says, understandable as it may be, is forbidden. Unatira may be even worse, that is, more difficult to control. And that is bearing a grudge, meaning, lahazkir ba'eshehu meitiv lemishaher aloi. If you do return a favor instead of an offense, and the other person who had refused to help you now needs help, and you say, now, look, I am not like you. When I needed help, you refused me. But I just want to show you that I am magnanimous, and I am willing to help you even though you really don't deserve it. And that is considered bearing a grudge. To tell him, Eze zikoron min harosh, also like to remind him of how he had refused to help you and how bad he was when you needed help. Now that too is forbidden. Inasmuch as one's inclination arouses one and inflames one's passion, and tries to get the individual to at least look, drop the guy a hint at least as to what kind of no good he is and how great you are, that you are acting so much more decent than he did. And if you can't, if you're not permitted to tell him openly make an obvious reference, overt, to what he had done, at least at least give him some sort of indication how much nicer a person you are than he was. For example, alright, you want to be a tzaddik and you want to give this guy back, you want to do this guy a favor even though when you needed and you were in such dire straits he refused to help you, and you want to be a tzaddik, alright, go ahead and be a tzaddik, but don't smile while you're giving it to him, right? So you won't say nothing, but at least show him what kind of louse he was. Look, you have an opportunity to get back at him and to do him harm. All right, you want to refrain from doing him harm. I'll give in to that. The Yitzhak will tell you. But if I'm a little bit, don't go out of your way to help him. But if you see a God, don't do anything major to help him. But look, you want to help the guy, go ahead, but do it in a fashion that he shouldn't know. Don't do it so that he should know it. I mean, don't give him any kind of gratification. Don't try to be his friend anymore. After all, he doesn't deserve it after what he did to you. And if you want to forgive him, and you don't want to appear to be his outspoken enemy, that was that good enough. And if you want to, you do want to associate with him, don't go out of your way to show him a great deal of fondness or affection. Any other kind of such attitudes, these are the strategies of the Yetzer Hara, how he tries to seduce people to develop bad traits. Therefore, the Torah came and gave one overriding rule. Shehakol nichlo boy, that includes everything. And that rule is, ve'ahavta l'reacha kamecha, that you love another person as you do yourself. Kamecha b'li shum hefresh. Kamecha means just like you would yourself, without any distinction. Kamecha b'li chilukim, without any separation, without any strategies or intrigue, kamocha mamish, as though it were yourself. Meaning, if an individual inadvertently hurt his foot, bumped into his toe, and he feels pain, obviously he's not going to hit his foot and say, "Why did you hurt me?" Because the foot is part of him. And even though he was hurt, he's not going to take revenge on his foot. He says, we understand that Klal Yisrael is one. He says, then you don't take revenge against someone else that has hurt you any more than you would on any other part of you. That is what is demanded by Ve'ahavta L'Re'acha Kamecha. And Rav Akiva says that this phrase, Ve'ahavta L'Re'acha Kamecha, is Klal Godel B'Torah. That is a all-encompassing rule of the Torah. And the who is it that says it on the all-encompassing? I think it was Rabbi Yeruchim of Mir, said the understanding of Klal Godel B'Torah means that everything else, every detail of Torah, must fit into the general rule. This is the encompassing rule of Torah. Therefore, anything that does not fit into that rule cannot be Torah. And no matter what it was, what it is that you do, if it violates Ve'ahavta L'Re'acha Kamecha, you may think it is the greatest mitzvah. Right? But if it violates Ve'ahavta L'Re'acha Kamecha, it is external to the rule and therefore is not Torah. And if we could allow ourselves to be guided by Ve'ahavta L'Re'acha Kamecha, according to the way this forum say it, our lives and behavior would be significantly different. And overcoming grudges is it's emotionally extremely healthy. And if necessary, what one can do to eliminate that is simply to go over to the person who offended you and say, look, I've got something that I've got to get off my chest. And you tell him privately what it was. He may offer an explanation as to why he did it. He may apologize, and you're able to get over the resentment and go on with out something festering within yourself. So the concept of avoiding revenge and grudges and bearing resentments is emotionally very healthy, as well as being a mitzvah, and really does not require any kind of supernatural effort. Simply going up to the person and coming to an understanding about what happened is likely to eliminate the problem in the great majority of cases. Furthermore, other kinds of transgressions to which a person may be prone, even though he may think himself to be observant of mitzvahs. Ulam hashvuos, taking an oath. Avopisha minastam, kol she'enu min ahedyotos, nishma mahoitz yishem shemayim yipiv levatolo. Generally, a person, unless he is really totally separated from Torah and mitzvahs, will be careful not to take the name of Hashem in vain. Kolshke mishua, certainly people will be cautious not to take a solemn oath that is not true. However, what we may not be aware of, and inadvertently transgress this, yesh oid eiz anofim ketanim, there are branches of this, even though they may not carry the same severity, nevertheless, I'll call upon him. If someone wants to be clean of all defects, and this is the chapter that we're talking about, the particulars of cleanliness is how to avoid any kind of contamination. So the one who wants to be completely clean of these has to take the extra precautions not to promise things, not to assert things in such a way that approach the concept of a shvua. B'humasha omru, as the Talmud says, Omer Abelazar, lav shvua behen shvua. A positive assertion can be an oath, and a negative assertion can be an oath. Omer Rava says, let me give you an example. B'huda omer lav lav trezimne, b'huda omer hein hein trezimne. If an individual enforces what he's saying, so he said no, and then he said no, I'm telling you no. Right? Yes, yes, yes. It really is that way, yes. He says, look, if you said it once, that's a statement, right? If you repeat no twice, or repeat yes twice, and reinforce what you said the first time, the second time already takes on somewhat of a quality of an oath. Like, I swear it is like this. Right? Now, even though it is not an actual expression of a shvua, but simply asserting the thing twice is can be something analogous to a shvua. My grandmother told me that when my great-grandfather, who was her grandfather also, came to visit, and she was a child at that time, and she said about something, believe me. Right? And so he said to her, you shouldn't say that. Believe me is an oath. Believe me is a shvua. And she was a child at that time of something like six. Later on, her mother asked her, what did Zayda say to you? She said, I can't say. He told me not to say that. But the idea is, when you say, believe me, accept my word, take my word for it. Right? And he says, take my word for it is an expression of a shvua. Right?
Would this comment such as, to be honest with you.
To be honest with you, I promise, right? Any kind of statement that is more than the assertion, he says it may not have the force and the severity of placing your hand on a sefer Torah and taking a solemn oath. And he's not saying that. He says, but nevertheless, he says, a person who wants to be completely free of having taken a shvua in vain should be careful. V'chein amru, as the Talmud says, the Talmud takes the verse of the Torah where the Torah says you should have honest measures, right? In the biblical times, the hin, heyud nun, was a liquid measure. And so the Torah says you should have a hin tzedek, a just hin. Now the word hin in the Talmud, in Aramaic, means yes. Right? So he says you should have a hin tzedek. Your yes should be true. Your yes should be just. That's the Talmud's interpretation. Sheyehe lav shalachot tzedek, when you say no, it should be valid. Vehen shalach tzedek, and your hin should be true. There are many stories about shvuas, and in my book Generation to Generation gave a long story about a shvua, which I'm not going to repeat here. You know, I mean, you want to look it up, How did Yogi Berra say it? You can look it up yourself. There is a story that they tell of Reb Rafael Bershita. Reb Rafael was a Talmud of the Mizritcha Magid, the great Magid. And he was a stickler for truth. His Hasidim were known to go to the extreme of truth. In other words, if they'd come outside, come in from outside dripping wet, and somebody would say, "Is it raining outside?" They say, "When I was out there, it was raining." Right? I mean, I'm not out there right now. How am I supposed to know if it's raining now? Right? Yeah, 3 seconds ago, it was raining. When I was out, that's the kind of thing that they describe about the Bereshit Hasidim. So they tell the story that there was a case where a Jew was indicted for some dishonest transactions. And the punishment in Tsarist Russia for a Jew was totally unjust. I mean, instead of receiving a sentence for making restitution and perhaps a penalty, could have been sent away for his entire life to Siberia. So it was really a matter of life and death in trying to save this person. They wanted Reb Rafael to come and testify to this person's honest character. And that would have required taking an oath. And Reb Rafael was in a quandary because he had never taken an oath in his life, even for something true. And here they were requiring him to take an oath, and yet, if he were asked to testify and refused, that would be tantamount to saying that the person was dishonest. And Reb Rafael sat up all night crying and praying to God, and he died in that night crying. He died in his tears. And they cite that as an incident of how, as an example, of how severe a shvua was. The Talmud says that among the entire Ten Commandments, when Hashem said, "Do not take the name of Hashem in vain," the earth trembled. And Shavua, an oath, has always had a much more serious connotation and implication than almost anything else. So people would, the Talmud is full of cases where there was no evidence on a case, a person was required to swear, and it was assumed that a Shavua would bring out the truth. And even an individual who might have been suspected of being dishonest, right? And they're saying, "No, I don't owe him the money." "Well, swear to it." "What do you mean, swear to it? If you suspect me of being dishonest, what good is my shvuah? Right? If you think that I really owe him the money and I'm lying about it, why are you going to accept the shvuah?" And the answer is that a person might even withhold money from another person and be dishonest, yet when it'll come to a shvuah, he will admit. Mm-hmm. Because a shvuah was accepted psychologically as having enormous importance.
Another question, if I may. Forgive the analogy. It's not intended the way you sound. But how does this concept of voodoo, if in any way does it enter into what you're saying, where the person will say, "If you don't, then you may,"
I think what you're referring to is the concept that has been demonstrated that among those people who believed in the tribes that believed in voodoo or in the medicine man,
right.
If the medicine man pointed a bone at them, right, which was a condemnation, these people would lie down and within 2 or 3 days would die from that.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that was described by Cannon in his research in physiology. Mm-hmm. He tried to establish what the mechanism of death was, mm-hmm, but it was a well-established phenomena, and it just shows how effective our emotional status can be. And we see this also in modern writings where Norman Cousins talks about having a positive attitude, and a bright attitude can help an individual even overcome a very serious disease. Now, whether one can laugh oneself out of death is controversial. But that one can cry oneself into death and become so depressed that one gives up and one just expires from despair is not at all that difficult to perceive. So he points out that even in ordinary conversation, let alone in commercial transactions where there might be an actual oath, but even in ordinary conversation, saying, I promise you I will do that, right? Or take my word for it, or any such other example, should be taken with the utmost severity because they are something similar to a shvuah. Needless to say, taking Hashem's name in vain is not only when one says a shvuah, but sometimes when one utters an expletive, right? And says, gee, damn it, right? Which is not at all uncommon in a moment of frustration and anger, that too is taking Hashem's name in vain, and furthermore, it is uttering a curse. So one has to be extremely careful if one wants to achieve this attitude of cleanliness. It's important as far as midas are concerned to realize that midas are character traits are compatible or incompatible with one another. In other words, reverence, consideration, love of another person, all of these are compatible. Envy, resentments, revenge, all of these, they are compatible with one another. But group one and group two are incompatible. Now, what happens is that if you are going to design a room or redesign a room and you bring in something of a certain style or a certain color, right, then you say, well, wait, now that I've done this, well, the rest of the room is now out of compliance. It doesn't fit, right? Now, the decor, this is just awkward here, so we have to change the furniture to match the rug. Well, now that we've changed the furniture, the drapes are no longer compatible, so we have to change the drape. And now that we've changed the drapes, now we've got to change the pictures or whatever. When you change one thing, the others may have to fall into place because they're not compatible. And in changing character traits, if we begin to change one trait and make it positive, we then set up a system where the decor is no longer compatible, right? And we have to begin to make other traits. So if one will, for example, start off with absolute honesty, he's going to find that vengeance and grudges don't go along with that, right? So that it is not as difficult as one may think to change one's character traits. All you have to do is begin with one positive character trait, and then it's much more likely that the system itself will require you to come in compliance, just as you would not have one piece of Oriental furniture in a room that is totally modern. It's simply out of place. So the key is to begin with something. Once you begin, it becomes much more easier to develop. To be continued. We're continuing now with the necessary precautions one must take to avoid transgressing averas that can occur in the normal course of the day, the kinds of things that a person may not give as much attention to as, for example, going out and eating something non-kosher. And in the line of this, he refers to Vihine Dvar HaShekev Gam Hu Cholera. There is a terrible disease consisting of falsehood, speaking falsehood. And this too, Mispashet Ma'id Mivnei Adam, has become very prevalent And it's even contagious. The Ula Madregas, Madregas Yeshpoy, and there's very various levels of sheker, of falsehood, that must be avoided. And again, this is in the line of things that people will sometimes stretch the truth and justify it in whatever way. So he says there are various levels at which lying can occur. Yesh b'nei adam, you have some people, shemunosa mamishu shakonis. They appear to be professional liars. Right? Their occupation is lying. Vehem, these are the people, ha'holchem u'boidim melivam k'sovim gemurim. They go and fabricate total lies, absolute lies, simply laman ha'besicha ben ablias, simply in order to have something to talk about. And people who sit around doing nothing, who may have empty heads and nothing else to discuss, sometimes fabricate stories.
I know people who lie when the truth is, and the truth is even better.
There are such people as pathological liars, and I've seen them, and they will lie to their own harm.
Yeah. In their own defense, the truth would be absolutely
would
perfect.
Would be absolutely
they
much
lie.
Better, right, right. Of course, in addiction, this is extremely common. An addict must lie in order to have an addiction lifestyle. And one of the things that's interesting that happens in recovery from addiction is that people who take their recovery seriously will avoid people, places, and things that could lead to a relapse. And some of them have said to me, I can't lie anymore. I can't even tell the kind of white lie that people normally do. Because for me, lying is part of my addiction. And if I begin to lie, it's only a matter, a short period of time before I'll go back to drinking or using. So some people are absolutely truthful. I have a little skit that I wrote in the last election entitled, How Truth Could Finally Come to the White House. And my suggestion is hire, elect a recovered alcoholic. You've got a better chance. At any rate, he says,
so far, those we have elected have not recovered.
The professional liar is someone who does so because of looking for some interesting things to make conversation. He wishes to give people the attitude that he knows everything. He is a know-it-all, so there's no way he's going to say that he doesn't know anything. So, yes, he knows this person, knows that person, and puts on a very superficial air of omniscience. And on, for them, about them, it is said, that the lips of falsehood, lying lips, are abomination before Hashem. And again, the prophet says, your lips speak falsehood, your tongues express wrong. And our sages have said about these people, there are four categories which will not be allowed into the divine presence in the world to come. One of them, a group of liars, people who are in a category of lying. This is not the occasional liar and saying that a person who ever told a lie will not be allowed in the presence of the Shechinah. As we will see, that is a sin which one can do tshuva on. But he's talking about people who are by profession liars, that they are totally rejected. There is another level. They are somewhat similar to them in degree. Even though they're not that far gone, they are also people who tell tales and fabricate stories. Vahainu, meaning, they don't go around constructing things that never occurred. Avol bevoyam lesapad ramo, when they do tell something that happened, yavo behem min ashkorim kemoshi yalavuchem, they will sort of elaborate upon it a little bit and tried to give some better color to the thing than it really was. And so they'll throw in some little frills of their own to the story. Now, it isn't fabricated out of whole cloth. It's just that they embellished it a little bit to emphasize their point or to make it sound a little more dramatic. The problem is that these people develop the habit of doing so, that it becomes second nature to them. And it's not any more willful lying. It's almost like the first group of pathological liars, the only difference being that the first group will take things and construct them out of whole cloth. Second group are not quite as far gone, but they do embellish the truth considerably and begin to believe their own lies. I had a fellow over here who was a tire salesman, and he said, nobody ever walks in the store without walking out with a purchase. He said he didn't come in here to buy shoes. He came in here because he needs tires. Right? He says, everybody who comes in, I got to sell them tires. And he says, it makes no difference what I say. Right? He says, I'll tell them anything, but I got to make the sale. He says, one day I came home and he says, and I said to my wife, was I ever in Minnesota? She said, no. Why? He says, because I was telling this guy about something that occurred to me when I was in Minnesota. I don't remember, was I ever there or not? So his sales technique consisted of spinning tales, and he did so habitually that he began to believe his own lies. And he says, this is what happens with these people. It becomes second nature to them. These are the kinds of liars. You can never believe them. Ukimamoram, as the Talmud says, Kacho anshe shel badai. The punishment of a liar is shefilo oimer emesen shemin loy, that you don't believe him when he tells the truth. And this person has totally lost his credibility.
What the difference between the first two classes? I don't understand. Is it that the one does it intentionally, and the other does it without even realizing it, or what?
The first one thinks stories up out of whole cloth.
I don't know what that means.
He invents a story.
He invents the whole story.
He's not embellishing. Okay. Right? The second one takes a factual thing, but
makes it more interesting.
It's a revisionist.
Mm-hmm. Right? What's the difference between that and hyperbole? Or is
nothing
it the same
really.
Thing?
Same thing. Same thing. And so the problem is with these people is that
hyperbole doesn't sound like lying, though. I mean, yeah. Oh, that's hyperbole.
Yeah, but the fact is that anything which is not truth is lying. There's really no, it either did happen or didn't happen. He makes an interesting point over here, where he says that these people become totally lose their credibility, and they believe their own lies. And he talks about that in the second group more than the first. It seems as though the first group, who totally fabricate things, know that they are lying, and are more likely to be aware of the fact that this thing never happened. It just sounds nice, so I tell it. The second group, who take a factual thing and embellish it, since it does have a basis in fact, are much more likely to begin to believe that things happen the way they say.
Isn't that pathological to a...
Yeah, but it's different than the first. And it's interesting that the more severe liar, as it were, is... less likely to deceive himself than the one who... that's quite true. An individual who knows that this thing didn't happen and he's just thinking it up because it sounds nice is going to realize that it was a lie and not believe his own tales.
The second group, after telling the story a couple of times, will probably pass the lie detector test.
Right, the second one...
Isn't that pathological?
Well, it's not. No, we refer to a pathological liar as somebody who spins tell tales, who just invented a whole cloth.
I know people like Alan's talking about, and I've seen it where a person will convince himself it's true, and then he's upset with the whole world because they won't. You know, he can't
talk to them after they got the ticket.
That can happen. That can happen. All he is saying is that the individual who begins with a grain of truth and distorts it and embellishes it is much more likely to believe his own version, right? That actually happened, rather than someone who just invented a story out of thin air.
After a traffic ticket, after an accident,
You believe that happened the
way you believe it yourself.
Sure. And, of course, this is the pitfall, and it's particularly difficult to correct a situation like this, because when you believe your own lies, there's no tshuva. How are you ever going to realize that it didn't happen that way?
That's why we have wives, to tell us.
And to invent tales.
So he says, these people, it ends up that they are never believed even when they tell the truth. They have so ingrained this habit within themselves that they're virtually incapable of telling something the way it actually happened. And this is what the prophet refers to when he bewails the prevalence of this trait. They have taught their tongues to speak falsehood. And they become habitually exhausted, as it were, because of their abundant lies. Then there's still more categories. There's the kind of liar, shechol yom kal mechol v'shenim. Their condition is not quite as severe. V'heim oysam, these are the people, she'enim kvuim kol kach v'sheker. They're not completely sunk into telling lies like the first two groups. Elo shelo yechushu lihisrachek mimenu. It's not an impossibility to tell a lie. I mean, they're not in the habit of doing it. However, and if it becomes necessary for them to lie for expedience, yemru, they will lie. Some of these people, pomim rabim yemru der schoik, okay, it's a bizarre. Sometimes they will do it in a kind of a jocular fashion. They're not even serious about it. They may not have any evil intent. The omnom hachocham hoidiyonu, Shlomo HaMelech tells us, shekolze, that all of this, even telling a lie for the purpose of levity, for example, jocular, who hefa chosin ha-boyer baruchu, is against the will of Hashem, umidas chasidov, this is opposed to piety. Hu ma shekosuv, this is why he says, dvar sheker yisne tzadik. A righteous person despises any words of falsehood. They tell a story that Rav Akiva Eger, when he married off whether his son or daughter, whatever, came to the wedding party or to the engagement party, whatever, and he was sitting with his mechutin, and the mechutin began to quip, as it were. Rabbi Kivega was familiar for never deviating a moment from the study of Torah. Rabbi Kivega said that he became a scholar because of the inter-semester, in between semesters, when most yeshivas released the students for Pesach and for Rosh Hashanah, Sukkot, whatever, and these were times when the young people did not concentrate on learning, and he says that's the time that he used that others didn't. So he used the precious minutes of time that other people wasted. It's like sitting at the airport waiting for a plane and doing nothing, where 20 minutes can go to waste. And he said he used those days and minutes that other people wasted, that's where he got his extra genius in Torah from. And it was known that he never spent a moment away from Torah. And so his mechutin just wanted to crack a joke, something like saying something to the effect, well, you're not as diligent in your study of Torah as you used to be. And the Rebbe Vega said, why, what happened? When did this happen? What was it that I did? He took it very seriously. And the mechutin said, oh, come on now. He said, I'm just kidding. And Rabbi Kivega got up and left. He was not going to stand in the presence of anybody who was going to distort the truth, even for the purpose of a joke. So he says, look, telling a white lie or an unintentional lie, he says that is a lie nevertheless. And the Torah tells us, Here we have the Torah warning us, Midvar Sheker Tirchok. Distance yourself from falsehood. Now the Torah says, already elsewhere, Loisi Shakru, do not lie. This is a second expression, and he says, you note that the Torah doesn't say, V'sira shalei omer mishaker tishomer, guard yourself from speaking falsely. You already said, Loisi Shakru, do not lie. And then the second precaution is, not guard yourself against a lie, but even more than that. Ela midvar sheker tirchok, distance yourself from telling a lie. Lahoyroisonu, to arouse us and to alert us, ala herchik hagodol, from the great distance that we should set up between ourselves and any kind of falsehood, v'habricha haraba, and the need to escape from anything that can even approach falsehood. Shetzorech livreyach mizeh, that one must flee from telling a lie. Ukvar nemar, the Novi says, She'eris Yisrael, the remnant of Israel, lo yasu avlo, will not do wrong, lo yedabru chozov, and will not speak falsehood, lo yemotze b'fiyem loshen talmis, and no deceptive words will be found on their tongues. Midvar sheker tirchok, to be remote from lying, would mean that if I do something which I may later on have to deny, that then I have not kept myself remote from a lie. Tirchok means do not even come close to telling a lie, and to avoid that means to not do anything that could possibly have to be denied later, and that is simply an excellent guide to behavior. You think, if I do this, is there any reason that I would ever have to deny it? Right? And if it doesn't pass that litmus test, right, then one should not do it. So truth can become then the absolute guide for a person's life.
Life can become boring.
I was at a shiur in Yerushalayim, where Rav Segal, the Dayan of Manchester, gave a shiur, and for several moments he, in his introduction to the, he elaborated on this midvar sheker tirchok, on one must distance himself from any kind of lies. And he said, there's no exception to this. And then he said, now look what you say in davening. Look what you say about yourself in davening. That all day we aspire to the help of Hashem. He says, is that true? He says, how do you say that? He says, if you're going to observe midvar sheker tirchok, then you better make certain that every word in davening, where you express your gratitude toward Hashem, that better be true. He says, otherwise, he says, you're lying with davening. He says, and there's no hetta, there's no permissibility for lying in davening either. The sages in the Talmud have said, Chois mei shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu emes. The seal of Hashem is emes. That if Hashem has chosen his seal to be truth, how much of an abomination is falsehood, the opposite of truth, before Hashem. Now we see that the Torah begins creation with Bereshis, Bara, Elohim, the last letters of which are Emes, which are indicated in the first three words of creation, and the last three words of creation is what we finish up with in Kiddush on the sixth day, Asher Bora Elohim Lasois. The last three words end up with the last letters being Emes. It has been pointed out that Torah and Mishnah and Gemara The first words of Torah that Hashem spoke to Kal Yisrael was Anochi Hashem Elokecha, was an Aleph. The first mission of Talmud begins Me'emas Aikarin Shema Ba'avis. From when do we read Krishma? The first word of the Gemara is Tane Mehechikoi. What is the Tane referring to? Right? So Anochi Me'emas Ai and Tane are Emes. So Torah is in many ways included within the letters of Emes to emphasize the centrality of Emes as being the basis of Torah. Furthermore, mathematically, 9 is referred to as the number that never gets lost. Any multiple of 9 always adds up to being 9. 18, 1 plus 1, 27, 2 plus 7, 36, 45, and you carry it through the millions, through the billions. Any multiple of 9 is always going to add up to being 9. This is because Emes, in the, if you remove the zeros and just with the digits, Aleph is 1, Mem 40 is 4, right? Tav 400 is 4. So in Mispar Katan, in diminutive number, which is the letter minus the zeros, Emes is 9. Right? And 9 is an eternal number. 9 never gets lost. And truth always persists, and truth always prevails. And the seal of Hashem is truth, because if you tamper with it and you turn it into something else, it is no longer the seal of Hashem. It can't be falsified, because if it's falsified, it's no longer the seal of Hashem. V'hizir HaKadosh Baruch Hu al ha'emes, Hashem instructed us about telling truth, as Hora Rabba, with many warnings. The Amar, and he said, Dabru emes isha le'eyu, speak truth one to another. The Huchan bechasad kisev yashav alav emes. Hashem made his throne, based his throne on chesed, on kindness, and sat on it in truth. Vayomer ach ami heimavei. Hashem says, they are my people, bonim le'ishakeo, children who do not lie. Halamadata, you see then, shezeh tolei bozeh, that to be children of Hashem, to be Hashem's people, requires us to have to be absolutely truthful. The nikra Yerushalayim ir ha'emes. Yerushalayim shall be called the city of truth, lahagdil chashivusa, and that indicates the importance and greatness of Jerusalem, that the true Jerusalem is the city of truth. No greater praise could be found than a city of truth. To be continued.